In Washington, I sit in the editorial staff of a newspaper. And in that position, I read reports about the problem of race relations, about the problem of human rights in the southern states of the United States. And these are very often terribly discouraging reports. What one hears in Washington about Little Rock, what one hears about the horrific and anti-democratic laws which some state legislatures have adopted to circumvent the Constitution of the United States, are terribly disheartening for the future of our country. Well, the discussion that I listened to last night solved no problem, but it provided, so it seemed to me, of those difficult and terribly important problems of racial relations. Last night, young people of both races sat together and talked calmly, constructively, civilly, and with a community of interest and concern about this difficult and crucial problem. I have, for my own part, no doubt whatever that if that kind of group discussion that took place here last night can be repeated and repeated over the country, that this problem of human rights will be met by Americans and will be solved by them. So that from what I heard last night, I took great heart, because it seemed to me that you, in this room, were grappling with a difficult situation in the way that Americans have traditionally grappled with difficult situations, and we're moving toward a solution of that problem in the only way that the problem can be met and solved, by talking it out, by sitting together and putting together your talents, your energies, your ideas, your skills, your knowledge. Now this, it seems to me, is what is called a community. And when this kind of common council can take place, you have a community. And through that community, you solve the problems that you share. I have a sense of tremendous encouragement that we in the United States are going to solve our racial relations problems. We are going to live together throughout this land in equality and in harmony, as a community, with equal rights for all Americans. Well, now I am going to talk about a different subject. I wrestled in my mind before I came here with how to distinguish for you meaningfully the difference between civil rights and civil liberties. And when I received the program for this conference, I discovered that it had been done for me, and done more simply, more concisely, and more meaningfully than I had any means of doing it myself. Last night you discussed human rights, civil rights, the right to be the same. And today we are to talk about civil liberties, the right to be different. I offer my warmest compliments and congratulations to whoever it was that devised that formulation of the difference. It seems to me admirably concise And it seems to me to offer, in a very few words, a real and full explanation of the distinction. Now, I'm not sure that I know how I ought to get at this. When I turned it over in my mind, it seemed to me that the most useful thing that I could do for this group was to attempt to formulate in fairly simple, elementary terms some definition of what are the essential civil liberties of Americans. What are, in short, the characteristics of this political system which give it its individuality, which make it essentially what it is. I'm not really very hopeful of making an important contribution, because I learned from last night that the important part of this conference takes place in the group discussion. But I do want, insofar as I can, to make some contribution, if nothing more than to provide a basis for the discussion later on, if nothing more than to provoke you into challenges of what I have to say. Now, what are the essential characteristics of the American political structure? I suppose that you could spend a great deal of time in group discussion arguing this question. And you could come up with a number of thoroughly valid answers. I will try one for size, on which I think there can be at least general agreement that it is among the important values, the important characteristics of the American system. I suppose that all of us here would agree that one of the fundamentals of American life is the idea that the individual human being is entitled to respect and to dignity by reason of his own individual human personality, by reason, if you like, of his divine origin, that each human personality is important in himself, important as an individual. And I suppose it's fair to say that no single idea is more basic to the American political philosophy than that idea of the importance, the dignity, the worth of the individual human being. And this, I suppose, is certainly one of the vital distinctions between any free community and a totalitarian political system. Among the totalitarians, the state is made supreme, and the individual members of society are, in a sense, servants of the state. But in a free system, in a free society, the function of the state is to serve individuals, to release the potentialities of individuals for their own growth. Mr. Justice Brandeis put this once in simple and eloquent terms. The men who won our independence, he said, believed that the final end of the state is to free men to develop their own faculties. And this, I think, is central to the political philosophy of the United States, that the function of the government, the function of the state as distinguished from the society, is to enable men to grow, to enable men to develop and to realize their own individual faculties and potentialities. Walt Whitman put it in his own wonderful simple poetic terms. The American compact, he said, is altogether with individuals. Now, there is, I think, a very dangerous tendency to think of disrespect for individuality and to think of the tolerance of diversity and the encouragement of individual differences, which inescapably grow out of a respect for individuality, as luxuries, as indulgences, as something which is somehow in conflict with the security of the nation, and which in times of stress must be modified and brought into conformity with the interests of national security. I think this is a fundamental fallacy. And the essential burden of what I want to set before you this morning is simply this: that individual liberty so far from being an impediment to security, so far from being incompatible with national security, is in fact indispensable to security. Individual liberty, so it seems to me, is an asset and not a liability. And the freedoms which are embedded in the United States Constitution, which are the bedrock on which the American political system has been built, those liberties are a source of strength to the nation, as well as a source of enrichment and of happiness to the individual human beings who enjoy them. I think that no more dangerous fallacy has been propounded than the idea that there exists some kind of cleavage or conflict between individual liberty and national security. On the contrary, they are complementary to one another. There must be national security, of course, in order to sustain and defend the liberties of Americans from threats from totalitarian dictatorships on the outside. We must, of course, as a nation, I think, be in a posture in which we can defend ourselves against threats from the outside. But in achieving that posture, we must recognize, too, it seems to me, that the liberties which we enjoy as an inheritance from our fathers and our grandfathers are sources of strength to the nation. They are the genius of the American community. They are what bind and hold us together. They are what make a community out of great numbers of people with different interests and outlooks and backgrounds. They are what have accounted for our growth to greatness, and they are those liberties what have made us, so far at least, invulnerable to threats from the outside. Now, one could talk a very long time about the civil liberties that are brought into American life through the Bill of Rights and the Constitution of the United States. I must do it, for lack of time, in a very superficial and in a simple way. I mean to talk to you simply, not ignoring, but simply not enumerating or detailing the great procedural rights which are guaranteed by the Constitution in the Fourth and Fifth and Sixth Amendments.